This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
You could spend the weekend doing the same old whatever, or you could conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
Texans training camp is happening now. Sports Radio 610 presents Seth Payne and Sean Pendergast.
Hey, what's happening, everybody? Happy Thursday to all of you. Nice to be with you. Appreciate you making the show a part of your day. Appreciate you getting up early with us. We got a lot to get to. A lot of Houston stuff going on. And good to be with you on a Thursday morning. I am Sean Pendergast. He is original Texan Seth Payne. Seth, very good morning to you. How are you, my friend?
Good morning to you, Sean. I'm trying to figure out exactly how we should handle all these various things that have happened. Should we start with the worst and move on to the best? Should we start with the best and move on to the worst?
Build to a crescendo. It's funny because let's start there. It's Texans practice today, practice day five. We'll get to plenty of Texans stuff as we roll on here in the 6 o'clock hour. It's weird right now because I feel like every day there's a new injury with the Astros, and yet they're in the middle of a 7-game winning streak. So it's almost hard for us to extract the worst from the best because they're intertwined right now. To me, the best thing going on, just in terms of success, is the success of the Astros, who continue to, you know, be a genie kind of came in and screwed up the streak of great pitching performances this team has had. On the scoreboard, it looks like the pitching performances weren't that great, but Fromber was awesome. Biagini came in at the end. They beat the Rockies last night, if you're just waking up, 13-6.
They beat the pants off of them.
They did. It was an old-school Astros romp. They had like 20 hits in the game. Kyle Tucker had a single, two triples, and a home run. Do you think, Seth, if Kyle Tucker had known he was going to hit a home run later in the game, that he would have pulled up at second on one of those triples?
Because, just to go for the cycle.
Yeah, he would have the cycle, man.
I think the whole beggars can't be choosers thing applies at this point.
And take your base, Kyle.
Thank his lucky stars that he's playing in Colorado, where his ability to pull every single thing he hits doesn't hurt him quite as much. And especially, look, the pull doesn't hurt you if you hit it out of the park now, does it?
It doesn't.
Two scoops of creatine a day, Kyle Tucker. That's all I'm telling you. It'll be like every park has thin, high-altitude air.
Seth, I'm going to say this. I know it was Coors Field, and you know, it's one game. I think we'll caveat it with that. But I will say this, that the triple that Kyle Tucker, his second triple that he hit, where it was a high and outside pitch, and he went with the pitch, and he drove it to the left center field gap, that was a really encouraging hit overall for Kyle Tucker. This wasn't one of these deals where he's trying to pull everything. It's a seeing eye single or what. That was a piece of hitting where you go, okay, maybe the light is going on for him. Maybe. Yeah.
Well, he is trying to go opposite, and he did on the one hit to left center.
Yeah.
And look, you can see it all there, and he still is. Including on that first triple when he kind of stumbled around the bases, he's like an awkward fawn still, where you feel like he's got to grow into his body at some point. And I think maybe that's all part of this season, is just kind of figuring out a way to cram his lanky body onto a baseball diamond. And he's starting to figure it out.
He's going to, for better or worse, he is going to be getting regular at-bats in the middle of this lineup, because the bad bit of news that came out of the Astros' seventh straight win yesterday was that Alex Bregman is the latest Astro to go down with an injury, and it's an injury we've seen before. It's a hamstring injury. Bregman pulled that hamstring back in his rookie year in 2016, missed a bunch of time with that. This is something that has ailed Bregman in the past, and he said after the game last night that, well, we'll just have to go day to day here.
Just disappointed. I want to be out there every day playing with my guys. And was starting to feel pretty damn good. I think right now, just go with it day to day, see how it feels tomorrow.
All right, so that's Bregman. Seth, my big takeaway when I heard some of the Bregman audio this morning is just, man, can you imagine in football a player getting an injury in a game and then going to the podium after the game? Not in a million years. At least not with the Texans, I don't think. Like a player who gets hurt just, you know, winds up at the podium like, yeah, here's how my hamstring feels, and we'll just go day to day.
Yeah, they usually do that, though, right?
Do they? Has JJ gone to the podium any of these times? He's gotten injured
after
the game?
Not JJ, but most guys, I would imagine. I don't know.
Yeah.
I guess, I don't know.
Football feels like the Kremlin compared to these other sports.
I mean, we've got good – there's quite a few the clips of, like, various depressed football players after they've been injured, I guess, unless they're off getting an MRI.
Yeah.
But Bregman's injury doesn't concern me nearly as much in terms of the Astros this season, because I feel like Bregman will likely be back by the postseason. I feel bad for him that it's going to be hard for him to kind of, I guess, turn this into a typical Bregman season.
Yeah, it's...
You know, like, he's sitting in he already worked his way back up to an 860 OPS.
Yeah.
But he's been above 900 the last 2 years.
And when he's been great lately. Look, this is a team that just heard yesterday that Yordan Alvarez is going to be out for the year. That was the other bit of news. That Yordan is not just that the knee hurts and he's going to be day-to-day. He's done for the season now. It's a torn patellar tendon. I know we're going to talk about that more later in the show. Michael Brantley is on the injured list. George Springer feels like he's in and out of the lineup. We just don't know. He's a yo-yo right now. You don't know with George Springer. So this team needed the version of Alex Bregman that we'd seen the last week or two if they were going to continue to ascend in the standings and stay in the playoff hunt. So they're going to need performances like last night. I mean, obviously that would be great. They're not going to go get 20 hits every night. But guys like Tucker, you know, all of a sudden Altuve needs to get it back in gear. I know he had two hits last night, but neither of them were hits where I go, well, Altuve's back. It's, you know, seeing eye grounder and an infield single. Altuve needs to get his bleep together.
Right. And now the worst news, which I don't think we've actually said this yet, but or did you? Yordan's out
for
the season.
I just said it, yeah.
You just said, okay,
yeah.
I don't know if you said that he was completely done and out for the season. I think the good side of that is that he's had these chronic knee issues for 2 years. And I saw a lot of people yesterday saying, well, how come this wasn't diagnosed earlier? What are the Astros hiding from us? It's not so easy to diagnose a partially torn patellar tendon. Hmm. I had the same thing when I was a player, and it sucked because for 2 years they thought I had just really bad tendonitis. And you feel like a wimp because you feel like you're not handling your tendonitis as well as other people do. I would just collapse sometimes when I was running. And I had a couple MRIs done, and it never showed anything more than maybe a little bit of blurriness in one spot. So finally, I was having shoulder surgery anyway after a season, so I said, let's just cut this knee open and see what's going on with it. And lo and behold, there was a huge chunk of my patellar tendon torn off the patella, like the whole middle third of it was, and I was running around with that thing all the time. So hell yeah, it was more painful than tendonitis. I'm hoping for Yordan's sake that that's what this has been the last couple of years, because that's a hell of a lot better than arthritis. It's a hell of a lot better than some congenital condition that's going to bother you for the rest of your career. So Yordan might get this fixed, and perhaps his knees won't be an issue anymore.
How were you after it got fixed?
I was fine afterwards. My knee issues later on down the road were all ACL related, and so as part of one of those ACL surgeries, I had the other patellar tendon operated on. They take the middle third of your patella to use as the graft for your new ACL.
Yeah.
And that, so when you talk about how long of a rehab is it, a lot of times the limiting factor in an ACL rehab is actually rehabbing that patellar tendon that they use as the graft. So Yordan, if that's the issue, if all it is a partial tear of the patellar tendon and it's not an extreme partial tear, then he should be back by spring training next year, I would imagine. It's like an ACL rehab.
When did this happen to you? Were you a Texan or were you a Jaguar at the time?
I was a Jaguar.
Okay, so you were fairly young.
Yeah. And I was actually, I said on Twitter last night it was after my rookie season. It was actually after my second season. So
okay.
I went through two seasons in the NFL feeling I had injured my knee squatting, like preparing for the combine, and I thought it was just tendonitis, and I played on it for the next 2 years and was just miserable the whole time. It felt like somebody was stabbing a knife in my knee the whole time.
Okay, so you played your first 2 years in the NFL with this condition in your knee.
Yeah.
The same way
Yordan's
played the first 2 years in the major leagues with this condition in his knee. So
Potentially. We don't know for sure that he's had it this whole time, but I'm hoping for his sake that's what it's been.
Yeah, well, what I'm hearing you say is that this might be good news, right?
Right,
I mean, I know it's bad news that he's getting surgery and he's out for the season, but the concern with Yordan for me, and I think for most Astro fans, and it sounds like for you, was more about 2021, 2022, 2023. It was more about the future for you, Don, than it was for 2020. Like, if this is something that is just he's going to be walking around with forever, then he's not a viable solution for this team long term. If he gets the thing fixed, now all of a sudden he comes back, he's not feeling pain anymore. I mean, can you imagine? Jordan's been playing with this now, and he had 78 RBIs in 87 games last year.
Right.
Like, he gets the thing fixed, and now all of a sudden, holy crap.
And he might be more athletic than we realize, too, because it does. It affects everything. Yeah. You know, and it affects your leg strength. It affects your speed, your ability to slow down, all of that. So we might get back a different Jordan.
That's good. Good insight from Seth Payne, who had the patellar tendon issues back in the day. All right, Texans training camp rolling on here. Practice again today, 9:30. Practice today over at the Methodist Training Center. I will be over there. I get my COVID test at 8:45. And then practice at 9:30. I was behind Laramie Tunsil and Whitney Merciless in line yesterday, Seth, for my COVID test.
I heard they jumped in front of you.
They did. It's like
bullies in the cafeteria.
No, it was more like Clear at the airport, you know, or TSA pre.
They basically paid a premium to get in there. In this case, it's because they get paid more than you, much more than you.
It is. I joked on Twitter that, hey, the first three people to go in our group were Laramie Tunsil, Whitney Merciless, and me combined, not to brag or anything, but the three of us make over $35 million a year combined.
that's a strong point. You're like that third Wahlberg brother that has the burger thing that they just kind of gave the charitable, like, yeah, we'll fund your burger company.
I'm Cooper Manning. That's what I am. Laramie Tunsil is a massive human being. I just want to get that out there. All right. The coolest trend in 2020 for the kids out there, bubbles. More proof the NBA nailed its plan, and talk of the NFL following suit. We will tell you exactly how they may do that next. Seth, good news out of the NBA bubble. They had another clean COVID sheet yesterday.
I'm surprised you even mentioned it. Come wake me up when there actually is a positive result.
I hope that's not the case. I hope I don't have to wake you up.
Why don't we go over, hey, the sun rose today. These are just things that I expect.
Yeah. Okay. No NBA player, this is as of yesterday, this is from Shams Charania of The Athletic. He says, zero again, no NBA player has tested positive for coronavirus out of 341 tested at the Orlando campus since last results were announced on August 12th. They are, Seth, since they've gone into the bubble, they are literally pitching a perfect game in the NBA bubble. Any super skeptic of the NBA bubble needs to show themselves. They need to be freezing cold taked. They need to, because there were people out there saying, well, this will never work. All it takes is one person to get into the bubble, and then it's just going to rip through everybody. And which I guess technically is true, but they're doing such a good job of keeping everything out of there and making sure everybody in there is tested and negative for the coronavirus. This is a system that has worked, and it's got a lot of people talking about how do we replicate this for sports. Maybe not for a full postseason like with the NBA, because the numbers help the NBA, right? Like, there's only 15 guys on a roster. There's only 37 total in the traveling party, at least initially, before, you know, the first round of the playoffs are over. They can have some guests come in that'll have to be quarantined and tested. But there is talk with the NCAA tournament, the basketball tournament, and now talk with the NFL that, man, do we look at doing a bubble once the postseason rolls around?
I think it's going to be a moot point by the time the postseason rolls around. For one, we're having so many tests rolling out that it's hard to keep up with. One of our listeners just emailed me yesterday about a test that they've come up with at Harvard that costs $1 that's less accurate, but at the very least could really help with screening it for companies, or if you can take it at home and it only tests you, like, when you're at your most contagious, it'll catch you. But for right now, that's way better than anything else they have out there. And then as all these tests are coming in where you can use saliva and you get the results within an hour or just a few hours, that's where we are right now. I think by the time January rolls around, and certainly by the time the tournament rolls around, regardless of where we are with the vaccine, because there will likely be a vaccine by that point too, I mean, almost definitely at this point, then I think you got to have a contingency plan where maybe if there's a second wave or a new version of the virus, or I don't know, COVID-21 comes out. But I don't think they're going to have to use that contingency virus.
Yeah,
and I have to say, at this point, I'm more optimistic than I am pessimistic that we'll be much closer to normal back by January.
Yeah, of all the sports, and that was the story yesterday, by the way. I'm not just kind of casually throwing out, hey, all these other sports might do this. And Mike Florio has a story on Pro Football Talk. NFL doesn't rule out a postseason bubble. And I guess Troy Vincent, who's the VP of football operations for the league, former defensive back, was asked about it on a conference call, and he didn't dismiss it. And I think the NFL, I think all the sports have been, the professional sports at least, have been pretty good about having all sorts of different contingency plans in place, you know, based on things that happen. And down the road, the NFL has said that they've at least looked at a bubble. I think of all the sports, Seth, the one that I least want the bubble, just in terms of how it impacts the on-field product, is probably the NFL. And the reason for that is, one, they've added that seventh team to each conference in the playoffs. So that first seed is the crown jewel. Like getting the bye and the home field advantage throughout the playoff. We know how important a bye is for your chances of winning a Super Bowl. I don't know that the Texans are going to be that team that's the one seed. I just hope they're one of the seven playoff teams, I guess, at this point, if they win the division again. But for the sake of fairness, I would hate to see a team go through the season, win enough games to get that number one seed. Now all of a sudden they're playing in this neutralized, sanitized, sterilized bubble.
I just naturally care more about football than I do basketball. Yeah. I think that I still haven't seen what the product's going to look and feel like in football. But Lamont, our listener, did correct me a few weeks ago when I said football was most affected by crowd noise. Because I went and looked, and I think it's basketball. Maybe college basketball, then NBA basketball, whatever it might be. We are missing that in basketball, but we're seeing it right now, so we don't have to imagine or think about how awful it will be or anything. I guess if I cared equally about the sports, I'd say I actually would rather have the fans in basketball. It's such a – because it's really – the fans are part of the game. I mean, the fans, as far as we can tell now based on the bubble stats, the fans actively affect shooting percentages, you know, and sight lines and all that stuff. So I'm pretty cool at this point with no fans anywhere as long as we have to keep it up. I'm not, like, emotionally – I'm not emotionally affected by it right now when I think about the football playoff.
Yeah, I just like it does now that we're into a basketball playoff where it's being played in a neutral bubble everywhere. It does bother me a little bit. Look, I'm still enjoying the games. I watched plenty of basketball yesterday. Can't wait to watch the Rockets this afternoon. But it does bother me a little bit, I guess, that there's really no the court that you're playing on in the stadium that you're in and the city that you're in has zero impact on the ebb and flow of a seven-game series. Normally, we would have watched that Rockets game on Thursday. We would have watched it on Tuesday. And if Oklahoma City is hanging around in that game, because the Rockets are the fourth seed and Oklahoma City's the five seed, so that game would have been in Toyota Center. There is a bit of a chess match that goes on about, man, we really need to protect our home court. Like, we cannot allow a split of these first two games. I don't feel that. Like, today's game, they're up 1-0. I don't feel like, boy, if Oklahoma City wins this game, they go back to OKC with all kinds of momentum. There's none of that with this series. So that is I'm still enjoying it, but that is an aspect of playoff basketball that we're not getting that I miss more than I thought I would.
That's a really good point, Sean. Stealing home court advantage. We haven't heard that once, right? We haven't, like, there's not, it's not going to, and we won't, other than jokingly, that somebody will steal home court advantage. It's not a concern. And then also, I think when you talk about the big swings in momentum, there's, hey, taking the crowd out of the game, letting the crowd back in basketball, especially if a team is down and starts to get hot, how that feeds into the crowd and the energy and everything. I think I miss it more in basketball. And yet I'm loving watching basketball.
No, I am too. That's what I'm saying. It hasn't affected, like, it's not that I'm not enjoying it. It just slightly affects my, It just slightly affects the vibe of a playoff series for me.
Did you notice during the game, I'm trying not to pay attention to the crowd noise too much because I want my subconscious to just kind of be fooled with it and go along with it. But when I did notice it, I felt like they were doing a pretty good job of making it sound like a Rockets home game.
Yeah.
There was more noise after a Rockets basket than there was after an Oklahoma City basket.
I don't know that there's any noise actually in the arena or if it's
right,
just
right, but
TV
I'm talking
noise.
About on the broadcast.
Oh yeah, yeah. I didn't really notice. One thing I did notice along those lines is they You talked about distracting players while they're shooting free throws. They do have the virtual fans behind the basket, too.
Yeah.
But, you know, waving, there were Rocket fans on the virtual screen behind the basket when guys were shooting free throws.
This is one of those questions I was embarrassed to ask because I feel like I should know this. But now I realize, there's so much I don't know about all of this right now,
right,
including which conferences are still playing.
You're
I don't
fine,
care.
Yeah.
So I'm not clear on whether they can see those fans or not either, or if they're superimposed on the
broadcast. No, they can see them.
They can definitely see those
fans.
Okay.
They are visible to the players in the arena, absolutely,
okay.
Yeah. All right.
Now I'm embarrassed. Thanks a lot,
no,
Sean.
No. Seth, during a pandemic, there are no bad questions. Was I dismissive of you? Was I condescending?
No, okay. You weren't at all.
Okay, gotcha. Damn, I should.
It's a filter I'm hearing it through because I would have been dismissive of you if you asked me and I knew.
All right, so
everybody knows, Sean.
Texans, hey, you do know that. So Texans training camp gets going again today. They have their fifth practice. I don't know if it's indoor or outdoors yet. We'll find out somewhere along the way here. But no practice yesterday. So on sportsradio610.com, I outlined some training camp battles. What do the participants involved in these battles tell us about the Texans' overall depth? We'll get into the individual battles. We'll answer that question next. Practice number 5 today out at the Methodist Training Center. I will be out there. I'll be calling into In the Loop with an update right after practice ends. I'll be calling in at 5:15 to Clint Sterner in the show. And I'll have a report for practice up on sportsradio610.com. Sometime around lunchtime is usually when I'm able to get that posted. So, Seth, I was thinking about this yesterday. I have a post up on sportsradio610.com about training camp roster battles. And as I sat down to do that, it wasn't that I had any specific ones in mind. It was just like, well, this is a logical time to do it. It's an off day. We're 4 practices in. This is normally where we would start to see some battle lines drawn for for roles on this team. And as I started to sit down and jot the ones that I've been kind of keeping an eye on, I'm going to myself, man, these are all backups. This is like the battle for the third tight end spot, because we know that Akins and Fells are the top two. The battle for the third running back spot, because we know who those are. There are no battles for starting positions along the offensive line. When was the last time that we said that in a training camp? Like this time last year, we're going, oh my God, is it going to be Matt Khalil or Julian Davenport? This is awful. I don't know what it says. Shouldn't a team that's forecasted by Vegas for 7.5 wins have more competition for starting jobs, especially on defense where they were 27th in DVOA last year? I can't think of one starter who's really in imminent danger of losing his job right now.
I don't know. Pro sports are, I guess, different in that that's you slot guys in there and you only had 5 draft picks. I think there are position battles. I think Brennan Scarlett versus Jonathan Grenard, a draft pick, could be a position battle. Okay. In a normal year where there's an actual training camp, I think that Ross Blacklock versus either Angelo Blackson or Brandon Dunn, depending on how they choose to use them, in a normal year would be a position battle. I think there are position battles out there. There's just no way to actually have them because you can't trust a rookie until you actually see them in game-type environments against people that aren't on your team, that you haven't practiced against every single day, and you just don't know whether you can trust a rookie until they get out there and they show that they've absorbed the game plan. So I think there are quote-unquote battles at some of these spots. You're going to see it play out over the course of 4, 5, 6 games.
Yeah.
I think Jonathan Grenard will have some chances to play, and if he's out playing Brennan Scarlett in those plays, then he's going to have a chance to have more plays, and it'll go kind of like that.
Yeah, and obviously health is going to factor in as well. The Texans have been pretty fortunate through these first 4 practices in terms of health with these frontline guys.
And I also think another little maybe repositioning battle could potentially be, let's say Charlie Heck ended up having to play, was pressed into action somehow, and he did a pretty good job, and Titus Howard had moved down to guard when Charlie Heck came in, then all of a sudden Zach Fulton's pushed out of a job.
Yeah.
I don't anticipate or expect that, but that's what Charlie Heck's got to be thinking whenever I get my opportunity to play at left or right tackle because of injury, because he's a tackle and a tackle alone.
Sure.
That could push Zach Fulton out of a job ultimately.
Okay, so as I was mentioning, the battles right now where the battles that I'm looking at are really guys battling for spots on the roster, not necessarily starting spots. They're battling for jobs right now. Ben, can you play some mood music? Go ahead, Seth. You want to say something.
And I'll say, I guess, to answer your question, yes, I think it should be concerning because you have to remember, too, that some of these positions that we're saying, like, hey, this guy's just the starter. We're saying that about Eric Murray? Are we really doing that? Right. Like, hey, this guy's never proven himself really to be an every game starter before, but we're counting on him as a starter. So, yeah, you should be concerned that in your one of your most concerning position groups, you've got a guy who's been a career backup so far just slotted in as a starter.
I would throw in, too, that I think the Texans are better than a 7.5 win team. I threw that out there just because around the league, they're generally thought to be certainly in the bottom half, if not bottom third of teams in the league by a lot of experts right now. And I think it's mostly colored by the Hopkins trade. Like they think that this is a team that's being steered in the wrong direction. Bill O'Brien needs to prove a lot of people wrong that that's the case. I think they're better than a 7.5 win team, but I think they are a team that's, I don't think they're a team that's good enough to where I should go, well, these are the starting 22. That's it. We know who they're going to be in week one. I think your point is a good one though, that this is not a normal preseason. They're going to roll with guys that they know until they don't know about them anymore. And we may not know about these guys till week four, that kind of thing. All right. So the battles that I outlined in this post, Seth, we'll rapid fire these pretty quickly. The first one is the battle for the tight end spot behind Akins and Fells. We know that O'Brien's going to keep at least three tight ends. And the big question coming into the preseason, really two big questions at that position. One, would Jordan Thomas come in shape? Would he take the offseason seriously after coming in out of shape last year? And two, what the hell is Kahale wearing? Because he didn't get on the field as a rookie. He was on injured reserve all year long. I would say only one of those two questions has been answered so far early in training camp. Jordan Thomas has come in phenomenal shape, and I made the request yesterday on the afternoon show, maybe on the midday show as well. Don't ask me about Kahale Waring anymore. Until he does something in practice, don't ask me about him, because right now he's just a dude who's suited up for two practices and hasn't really done anything that stood out yet.
Yeah, and I guess this is one of those moments where, okay, Jordan Thomas, Jordan Akins, this is where you've got to really just come into your own. That third year in the NFL is where you take that. A lot of times guys take that leap forward where everything just clicks. Everything comes to them. And Darren Fells is he's an older guy at this point. Coaches and GMs just absolutely love replacing older guys with younger guys, especially that they feel like they've tutored and brought along. So Bill O'Brien will give those guys every opportunity to be better than Darren Fells, no matter how much they actually like Darren Fells.
Yeah, there was part of me that, as I'm evaluating this position battle, you know, it's O'Brien's show to run now, and I don't know if Kahale Waring was a Brian Gaines. He was drafted on Brian Gaines' watch. I don't know if he was somebody that Brian Gain drafted, and that was somebody who Brian Gain really himself liked, maybe more than the rest of the staff. So I got to thinking, like, man, I wonder if Waring's in any jeopardy at all. But then I thought, okay, well, Jordan Thomas is a Gain pick as well. So that thing, you know, that sort of evens out in the end.
Yeah, and I think, too, again, I think they've got three promising young tight ends there, and I think they can figure out a way to keep all four of them around if they have to. Especially, like, O'Brien was kind of gushing about being able to have three tight ends on the field all at the same time in practice the other day. Maybe gushing's too strong a word. Yeah. I also think that, look, I think Akins versus Thomas in terms of how many reps they get is still a battle, too. Thomas has showed up lighter than last year. He's going to be healthy. And I think that's a healthy battle amongst all four of them.
All right, the next one was the battle for kick returner / backup slot receiver, but more kick returner. It's been Kiki QT and DeAndre Carter largely getting the look in training camp so far this year. QT is at a good camp. He's another guy that's needed to come in. Conditioning, not an issue for QT. Health has certainly been an issue for him his first 2 years in the league, but knowing the playbook, knowing where to be, and making an impression in camp has been big for him as he's fighting for his football life right now. Before I get your evaluation of that one, Seth, here is Bill O'Brien earlier this week on Kiki QT.
You know, some guys it takes a little bit longer. You know, Kiki's had to deal with injuries, and then when he's played, he's been very productive. I mean, you remember his rookie year, he had big game against Indianapolis. You know, he's a guy that just has dealt with some hamstring, some ankle, and so I think the big thing for Kiki is health. He's a very confident player, very good player. Randall Cobb has helped him. You know, just watching how Randall Cobb operates, I think that's really helped him. He's had a good camp. I think he's done a good job returning punts. in camp, and in addition to his receiving duties. And, you know, he just needs to keep it going. And the big thing is health, which is really the case with a lot of guys. It's just some of their journeys to a consistent career take a little bit longer than other guys. And some of it's just luck, you know, it's either bad luck or good luck. So I think that he's on the right track.
This time last year, QT was being talked about as being part of a very potent trio of wide receivers with Fuller and Hopkins and QT. Now Fuller, you know, Fuller is the only one that figures in prominently right now of those three guys because they traded for Stills, and we know the other moves that have been made this offseason. Seth, do you have a dog in the fight in the QT versus Carter battle right now?
I still like QT just because he can bring more to the table, ultimately, I think, as a slot receiver than DeAndre Carter can. Also because my interview, I was going to be on Buffalo Radio yesterday, but Sean McDermott was late to his press conference, so I got bumped for Sean McDermott, apparently. Sure. So I'm going to go on Monday, and I just realized, oh, yeah, I'm going to have to talk about DeAndre Carter's non-fair catch signal in the playoff game. I'm going to have to talk about blindside blocks. People up in Buffalo are still quite angry about a few of what they perceive to be injustices in that game.
I would tell them to turn the page. If you had a baseball team, have them be part of a sign-stealing scandal and see how that feels when it comes to people coming at you, you know, when it comes to people not being able to turn the page. Yeah,
DeAndre, the DeAndre Carter, I was very defensive of DeAndre Carter and the Texans in that moment where I said, well, no, it's ridiculous. It's no big deal. What? Yeah, he messed up there.
Yeah.
He completely messed up in that moment where he basically gave the I'm not going to catch the ball signal and then caught the ball. It's not the same as a fair catch.
Right. I'm with you. I like DeAndre Carter. I think he's a great story. The guy was a substitute teacher 2 years ago, and he's in the league. He's managed to stick on the Texans roster. I'm rooting for QT because of the higher ceiling. I thought it was interesting, Seth, at camp the other day. I don't know that Bill O'Brien does or says anything without a purpose behind it. And there was a drill where they were running. They were doing like three on threes. The quarterbacks, you had three receivers lined up against three defensive backs, and they would the receivers would all run some sort of scheme, you know, crossing routes and stuff like that. And Deshaun would find the open guy, or AJ McCarron would find the open guy. And I don't think I'm giving anything away too much here. There was one. O'Brien doesn't do a lot of yelling during that drill, but DeAndre Carter got open in one of those drills and made a catch. And O'Brien yells out top of his lungs, "Great route, DC! Great route, DC!" And I'm thinking to myself, I wonder if that's a message to Kiki QT. You know what I mean? Like for whom running routes last year was the big issue. Kiki QT would find himself attached at the hip with teammates on deep routes last year.
like he was on a shadow program for
yeah,
DeAndre Hopkins.
Yeah.
I just like, hey, DeAndre, mind if I tag along? I'm drafting off of you.
Right. Maybe I'm reading too much into it, but O'Brien didn't yell and scream compliments for really anybody during that drill, but he yells one for DeAndre Carter with Kiki QT standing right there.
I think you're reading way into it. I think you've watched too much Sopranos, Sean.
Yeah, probably. All right. The next position.
You're just basically Uncle Junior at this point, looking at everything as a
total
possible
paranoid.
Slight
yeah,
or insult
totally
or
paranoid. Yeah, I know the feds are right around the corner. Yeah. All right. Speaking of wide receivers, as you know, Seth, Chad Hansen has been my guy during this camp so far. He's my camp crush. He made some plays early on in camp, got mentions from Bill O'Brien. Chad Hansen, Stevie Mitchell, Isaiah Coulter are getting a lot of reps with Deshaun Watson in the ones right now because Brandon Cooks and Will Fuller have not been doing a lot of 11-on-11 work. They're really conserving those guys, making sure they're ready for the regular season. So these are three guys that are battling for a spot on the roster right now. Does Coulter get a leg up because they invested a draft choice in him?
Yeah. Sorry, I thought you had a soundbite. Yeah, he always does, especially if he's a high enough draft pick that he's making the team. He's just fine. Like, unless he'd have to really, really suck to not make the team.
Fifth-round pick?
Yeah.
Fifth round
pick. Yeah,
okay.
It's rare for fifth round picks to get cut.
To get
in the rookie season.
Yeah.
And so I know this year's a little bit different because you can now look, I've heard people say, hey, you don't worry about this guy because you can just protect him on the practice squad. The player has to make it through waivers before you can put him on your practice squad.
Right.
So it's not as simple as, hey, we'll transition him directly to practice squad. So guys that are fifth-round picks, if people like them for any other reason and they see him out there on waivers, this year will be a little dicier for picking up guys on waivers because you can't go and look at their preseason tape and see how they progressed. You know, so if Isaiah Coulter had gone out and just been atrocious in three preseason games and then hit waivers, then he might pass on through. But if he showed any kind of promise, then he's going to be enticing to teams. I would guess just given his measurables and given that he's a smaller school guy and given that Bill O'Brien drafted him, when you draft a guy like that, it's a three-year plan. You're not keeping him based on how he looks in training camp this year. I'd be really surprised if Isaiah Coulter doesn't make the team.
Yeah, but one other team liked him in the draft process. It's like a free roll for that team. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's like, okay, now we can get him. We didn't have to give up a draft pick to get the guy. We can get him off the waiver wire. Third running back spot behind the two Johnson brothers, Duke and David. Right now it's Buddy Howell and Caron Higdon who've been getting most of the carries. This is a position where ultimately we could see a veteran come in if there's one on the waiver wire. But it's going to be tough to evaluate veterans. O'Brien talked about that a little bit earlier this week on signing players and bringing them in from the outside. It's a different process this year.
You know, you have an 80-man roster. You're very close to being down to what your team is, right? You know, so you have a 53-man roster eventually with a 16-man practice squad, 69 players. So, you know, you're a lot closer to what your team is going to be than you were in past years. Now, we do have workouts where we're bringing guys in, emergency list guys that may compete to be on the roster at some point in time. So we're doing that. Matt Bazergan is leading that charge. We had a workout the other day for a few players, and we'll continue to do that. But the workouts, you know, these guys, you know, in order to get them in for a workout, they got to come in 3 or 4 days earlier. They got to get tested for the COVID. They got, you know, so it's a much different process than it was in the past. Plus, you know, one of the rules says you have to have an intent to sign them, which, you know, I don't know what that means. That's pretty gray, but we're working through all those things.
I want to learn more about that today from O'Brien, Seth, that little part at the end there about the process of bringing guys in. It sounds like to me you're going to have to be a whole lot more inclined to find solutions on your own roster this year, especially once you get into the regular season where there's a game every week to get ready for. Than in previous years where you just bring guys in on a Tuesday, you work them out, you try them out, you send them home. It's a much more cumbersome process now. I want to ask him about that today. Howell versus Higdon. Higdon had a rough day the other day, man. Fumble, stopped twice at the goal line by Zach Cunningham in a goal line drill. So, I mean, you're a young running back that's an undrafted guy on the practice squad. You can't be putting the ball on the ground in practice. Like, that's the
death.
Wait,
that was Higdon, right?
That was Higdon who did that,
Higdon,
yeah.
Higdon that had the rough day, yeah. Yeah. So, and again, boy, all this stuff that I know coaches will always say, hey, it's more of the practices than the preseason games where they make their judgments. And that's true because you just have so many more reps in practice. But the games do sometimes vault a guy into making the starting team. If they ever some guys are gamers. Some guys just flat out don't practice well. One of my favorites all time was Dom Capers. Dom Capers used to tell me about Kevin Green. And Kevin Green, who's a Hall of Fame outside linebacker and a pass rusher, was just absolute garbage in practice. And it's not that he didn't try hard or anything. It was almost like I think he was always experimenting with stuff. And he just looked awful in practice. And he would get in games, and he was one of the best players who ever played the game. It doesn't have to be that extreme a difference, but you want to see sometimes if a guy just shows up when the lights are on, and you're not going to have a chance to see that right now.
Howell's got the inside track on that spot, mostly because we know he's going to make the team. He's one of their top special teams guys. Last position battle, Seth, this is one that'll be near and dear to your heart as a former defensive lineman. I think we know that five of these guys are making the team, starting, whatever. J.J. Watt, Brandon Dunn, Angelo Blackson, Charles Omenihu, who's been getting a lot of reps with J.J. out, and then Ross Blacklock, the rookie. Those five guys are making this team. Normally it's six, sometimes it's seven defensive linemen that they bring out of camp for the 53, but let's pretend it's six right now. It's a three-way battle right now, I think, between Carlos Watkins, Albert Huggins, who they brought in, again, this preseason, who they brought in last year as an undrafted guy, and then we'll see what P.J. Hall winds up being. Hall's probably the guy with the biggest upside. Watkins is the guy that the staff has the most experience with. What do you think the team winds up defaulting to for this last defensive line spot?
I've got a little bit of a soft spot in my heart for Carlos Watkins because he wears my old number, and
that's
he also, much like my friend Troy Evans, is very adept at getting on camera during a broadcast. Have you ever noticed?
No.
You see a whole lot of Watkins during the broadcast. I don't know if he does it intentionally or if it just ends up being where he's hanging out. Like he's hanging out next to a coordinator or he'll hang out next to the head coach at times. Troy Evans, who's a special teams captain for the Texans, ended up going on to win a Super Bowl for the Saints. He actually like made a conscious effort to get on camera because his family and friends got a kick out of it. And I would never do that myself, so I admire people who have got the guts to do it. I think PJ Hall has to prove A, that he can control his weight. I mean, when I watched him on film, it looked like he needed to play at a lighter weight. He's only 6 foot tall. He does not have the body of a huge run stuffer. And I don't know if the Raiders wanted him to be that big, but Bill O'Brien said, hey, PJ Hall needs to get his weight down and get in shape. So I think he's got a dark horse chance to do something, except that he's really got to hear the messages and get down to like closer to an Aaron Donald physique than a Vince Wilfork physique.
There you go.
You know, if you're going to have your poster up on the wall, I feel like PJ Hall may have been, you know, using a motivational poster of Vince Wilfork these last couple years.
Okay.
He needs to understand that he needs to aspire to be Aaron Donald. He has that type of athleticism. He's not going to be Aaron Donald, don't get me wrong. But, like, that's who, you know, like, just look, if I put a picture of somebody whose physique I wanted to emulate, I'm never going to get to that guy, but that's who I can dream and fantasize about. So I think Albert Huggins might be the dark horse favorite in this moment, just because he did some intriguing things on film last year. His measurables are not great. He was overshadowed by playing amongst a bunch of other really good defensive linemen in college.
Literally three first-round picks and Albert Huggins on the defensive line is what it was at Clemson. Yeah.
So depending on how Huggins looks athletically and how he plays during training camp, he might have a better shot because he's younger than Watkins at this point, then maybe they want to take a look at him.
He's done some things. It's harder to evaluate these guys that play in the trenches at these practices, even the padded practices, Seth, because they just try so hard not to go to the ground.
Yeah.
But 93 is his number. I've looked at a few times during these things. I'm like, oh, there's number 93 again. That's Albert Huggins. So we'll see what he does. Payne and Pendergast with you on a Wednesday. Just cleaning up a couple other things from O'Brien over the weekend, Seth, that I know you wanted to get your take out there on. Here is Bill O'Brien on... This is an answer to a question I actually had for him on how the things operate during practice with two new coordinators.
The way that we structure practice, really the way we always have is, you know, they're used to, in the beginning of training camp, you have a script, right? So you're trying to get installation, making sure that you get all your plays in, your situations, everything that you're, you know, you have a checklist, and so you have a script, and so you're just calling it off of a script. But as training camp goes on, the mode that we're in right now, there's really no script. I'll call out the situation. Anthony and Tim are on opposite sidelines with their units. They're substituting. They're calling the play based on what I've yelled out. Now, it's not the same because you don't have the coaches upstairs and things like that. But they're not able to just get into a robotic read off a script. So I think that is something that helped me when I was first starting out calling plays. I believe that helps them. We will definitely have a couple of scrimmages, you know, where we'll work game type operations. We'll have coaches up in the booth. You know, those guys will be on the sideline. Both guys will be on the sideline. I think it's important. They both have really good presence. It's important for their players, you know.
All right, so Seth.
The way that he's talking there about scripts, it might sound kind of strange to people because you're like, oh, this is an athletic competition, right? What's a script? That's the way it's done in the NFL a lot of ways, and it always drove me insane as a player because I'd see these guys act like robots and then not be able to make decisions in game or at the end of games, and it's because that's what they practice doing all week is not making decisions. They have the script, and the offense would have the 10 plays they know they're going to run, and the defense would know which plays the offense was going to run, and nobody's actually practicing making decisions. I'm really glad O'Brien is doing this. I honestly think more teams should do it, whether their coordinators are new or aren't. But, like, you know, head football coaches that make it in the NFL tend to be control freaks, and sometimes they start wanting their practices to look more like rehearsals than actual practices. I couldn't be happier that this is the way he's approaching this, because he's actually teaching people to think on his feet.
Very demonstratively approaching it this way. It's to the point, Seth, where they've built a huge scoreboard at the north end of the practice, the outdoor practice part, a huge NFL-style scoreboard with a jumbotron and everything, where they're literally putting up the down, the distance, the number of timeouts, and the clock. And they've got somebody operating the clock like it's an actual real game. The two-minute drill literally has a real clock with timeouts, and they stop it on incomplete passes. So it's not just a simulation where O'Brien is verbalizing things. It's a true simulation, even with the technology in the building there as well. All right, as we head into the 7 o'clock hour, reminder, download the radio.com app to bring our Texans training camp coverage with you wherever we go or wherever you go. 32 consecutive days of covering the Texans. We're in the midst of it right now. We're here for you. So your best coverage is going to be right here on Sports Radio 610. We've seen our fair share of season-ending injuries. This one carries a lot of long-term concern, though. Seth Payne is here to make you feel better about the Yordan Alvarez knee injury next.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance, too, with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.